Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Best-selling author Poe Bronson celebrates decidedly 21st century families in America and beyond in his new book, Why Do I Love These People? Families where daughters question their fathers, where mothers are better off without husbands, where children grow up with one parent. He looks inward at himself and his own off-and-on relationship with his own family. He looks at stories of infidelity and drug abuse and divorce and estrangement and resilience. And in this complicated mosaic, Poe Bronson sees hope. The family, he says, is more resilient than ever. Not in the 1950s style, but better. And the golden era of family is not behind us, he says, but ahead. This hour on Point, Poe Bronson celebrates the evolution of family. You can join the conversation. What is family to you today? A mom, a dad, and kids, or something else? And do you see a new understanding of family emerging beyond the Norman Rockwell version? Does it work? Does it work for you? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Poe Bronson. He's the best-selling author who came to fame in the go-go 90s of Silicon Valley. In 2002, he got down to basics in his book, What Should I Do With My Life? The True Story of People Who Answered the Ultimate Question. Now, he's x-raying the contemporary family in his new book, Why Do I Love These People? Honest and Amazing Stories of Real Families. Poe Bronson, welcome to On Point.
Tom, thanks for having me back. I really appreciate it.
So you really got to give us some compass settings here. We read all kinds of reports about what rough shape the family is in. I read just a couple weeks ago a new study out saying that children of divorce are more lonely, less able to establish good relationships. Looking here back 2001, the census figures came out and showed all kinds of numbers that people we're really concerned about in terms of how the family health is doing. You say the golden age of the family is ahead. Make your case.
The first thing, Tom, is that we're comparing ourselves to a mythic and idealized version of the past, not the reality of the past. We feel like we've lost something, but we have to reconcile that families never were as stable and traditional as we imagined they used to be. 100 years ago, a child had nearly the same chance of experiencing single parenthood as one does today, not from divorce, which was very rare back then, but from separation, desertion, abandonment, and particularly early death of parents. And if you define a traditional family as a male breadwinner and a female stay-at-home mom, and it's their first and only marriage, then never in America have a majority of children lived in a traditional family, not even in those 50s and 60s, that golden era for family. So we imagine that today we have this whole new host of problems, but in fact, people have always been dealing with this, always been tackling these poor odds, and in addition, we over the last 100 years, have added all new aspirations to family that we all pretty much agree on and think are important. The rights of women and the rights of children, and the change in a family from being a strict patriarchy ruled by strict obligations and the control of a father has become a family that is held together by choice and by desire. And that is a difficult rite of passage for families to make, and they are struggling with that in these days. But as we move on to that in the future and you see these families held together by choice and held together by love, we're going to have better families than ever.
Poe Bronson, you make this case through the examples of lots of stories, and you come out of it saying, in fact, most of the statistics that make our society look so bad are actually indicators of good things emerging, that women and children have rights, that we value some privacy and independence, that we hold the quality of marriages to a higher standard. We've got it pretty good, you write. The golden era for family is not in our past. It's in our future. You mean by that family with a different definition? Can you define it? What is family then, if it's not what it was?
I tell the story in the book of a guy named Steve Murphy who came from an old Irish family out of New Orleans that broke down 100 years ago. And Steve was raised by a single mother. He never knew his father, and his older brother died when he was young. And they were so poor, it was extremely hard, that his mother used to drop him off at the movie theater to watch Mary Poppins all day long.
That was his daycare.
Repeatedly. That was his daycare. And as he grew up, he thought, he became a successful young executive working for Kmart, and he was living in Phoenix, and he said, I'm not interested in family at all. And he had one kitchen chair at his dining room table and only one place setting, and he intended never to get married. But to his surprise, he ran into a woman named Jojo Tabayoyong from a very strong and very diverse Filipino family, and he fell in love. And Jojo and her 600 relatives welcomed Steve Murphy into their life, and Steve discovered that he had rejected what he imagined to be the definition of family, the kind of family that he came from, stoic and reserved and very small, but that he was not rejecting this other kind of family. In fact, his hope was being restored, and he feels like the Tabayoyongs have saved him. And in a way, it's this same cycle I see recurring. We do see families breaking apart, but we see people rebuilding. And throughout the book, I see these stories of people rebuilding.
Let me ask you about that one in particular, because, of course, what he did there was marry into a different culture, in effect. Not traditional, even American culture, but Philippine culture. Very, very family-oriented. As you say, a family of 600. So was he, in fact, saved by the traditional family values of another culture that have been lost in this country?
I believe that the immigrant cultures that are throughout America are restoring our notions of family, not detracting from them at all. And in the case of Steve and the Filipino family, that yes, this sort of traditional Filipino ideas brought family back into his life.
Paul Bronson, you write effectively on so affectingly on many subjects. Here you come to family, and from the get-go, your premise seems to be disillusion with the family. At the same time, we've heard, you know, family values championed all over the place in recent years. Do you see Americans today as fundamentally coming to family afraid, disillusioned, skeptical?
I thought that was true, Tom, when I began this book, because I think that was the feeling I had known. For instance, we hear that so many young adults are afraid of marriage. They're delaying marriage. They prefer to cohabitate, that they're too picky in marriage. And based on these messages, you might imagine that, you know, fully half of us aren't getting married, or maybe 40%. But the truth is, hope is alive and well for the women who are turning 40 next year, a class of people who are often bemoaned and told you've missed your chance. 83% of them had married by the time they were 35, and 92% will marry at some point in their lives. 92%, that's a lot of hope. That suggests that people are trying this, and that the message constantly being bombarded is dangerous, because it's letting these myths destroy our hope.
And the family that you would resurrect from that missing hope, from that barrage, it's not the Leave It to Beaver family, you say. So what is it?
I don't think it comes through any demographic test whatsoever, Tom. I don't think that what we want is great families, not just non-broken ones. And greatness fits no demographic test.
Do you mean mom, dad, and kids, or something else?
The greatest mother I met in all my research of 700 families was a woman named Mary Naomi Garrett. And she rose out of a tar paper shack in Cincinnati. She had 8 children in 11 years, working nights at the post office, and everyone told her, Mary, you're going to end up on welfare. But she sent 7 of her 8 kids to the best Ivy League colleges in the country. And the funny thing about Mary is that she's not the all-embracing mama figure we might imagine. She's no goddess at all. In fact, she's never driven a car, refuses to fly on planes, has weird phobias. Her favorite hobby is to watch basketball games.
What made her so good, then, as a mother?
Is love. The kind of love she gave to her children. And that's really what it comes down to, is it's the kind of love we give each other in our families. And we need to encourage and celebrate a kind of resilient love. that, again, fits no demographic test, and it doesn't really matter whether that love is coming from two parents or one parent or three parents or a parent and two grandparents or from siblings. It's the type of love we give each other that we need to focus on. And, I, you know, in terms of what makes a bond, what makes a commitment, I tell the story in the book of this man in the Ozarks named Doug Haynes, who woke up one day to the fact that he had neglected his son at birth 13 years prior. And he looked him up and tracked him down and found him in Florida, and he tried to make a bond with this child. That Doug was his biological father really made no difference. And when they moved in together, they tried to be best friends for 6 months, and that made no difference to young Gabe Wilkins. But the day that Doug and Gabe were kicked out of Doug's mom's house because she was tired of this mouthy little teenager, Doug went to Gabe and he said, "I'll live with you in a hole in the ground if that's what it takes. I waited too long to be with you. We will do it. We're a team and we'll stick together. Is that what you want?" And it was those words and that commitment that made these two men bonded together permanently now.
And family was back, but after a 13-year gap, there's the light in the dark, maybe. Light out of the dark. Poe Bronson, the new book is Why Do I Love These People? We've got to take a short break here. We're talking about the evolving family. Listeners, what do you think? What is a family to you today? Are we developing a new, more loosely defined, resilient understanding? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
These are the very words she uses to describe her life. She said a good day. She said her bad days when I lie in bed and think of things that might have been. Slip sliding away. Slip sliding away.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the evolving family. What family is and what it means to us now. You can join the conversation. What do you think? You've heard Poe Bronson. Are we developing a new understanding of family? And is that a good thing or not? Has family come easy to you or has it been hard? Do you ask yourself why you stick with these people or is it obvious? Have you given up, recommitted, redefined family? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Poe Bronson's new book is Why Do I Love These People? Honest and Amazing Stories of Real Families. Poe, you did a lot of footwork, a lot of shoe leather in this book, talked with lots and lots and lots of families, distilled it down to some pretty intense stories. I'd like to hear some more of them. You mentioned Doug Haynes and his son, Adam, and how they finally worked it out after a 13-year gap. Tell us more. I don't know. Where do you dive in? Maybe Ann Jacobson. That's an arresting story.
There's three stories in the book of couples dealing with and trying to survive one of them's infidelity. And in each of these three stories, which are spread out throughout the book, they do survive the infidelity, but they do survive it in different ways. The interesting thing that Ann Jacobson did, and she was a stay-at-home mother in Southern Virginia, was rather than just having an affair, she's a very honest woman. And so she went to her husband, and she asked his permission to have the affair.
Why? Why did she want it in the first place? I mean, you say she had a daycare center in her basement. She was not feeling good.
She didn't really know. I mean, I'm not sure people really know why they want to have the affair. And she agonized over this and whether it was something that she really wanted or not. And she wondered whether she simply had too high an expectations for marriage, that she was expecting it to sort of be blissful all the time, and because it wasn't, because it was a struggle.
She wasn't sexually satisfied with her husband?
She actually did not express it in that way. She maybe had some curiosity, but their sex life was okay.
What happened?
Her husband, who just wanted his wife to be happy, gambled and said, okay, and tried to be very open-minded about it. And Anne did have the affair. She saw this man a few times. Then her husband realized, I can't handle it, and asked her to stop, and she stopped. And they've been very honest and open about it this whole time. And the next year was very painful for them. And her husband moved into the basement for a while. And they struggled with whether they even wanted to continue this marriage. They had two young children. Anne had always been looking for someone to love her in an extraordinary way. And over the course of the next year, through not their first marital counselor, but their second, who was very good, they began to understand that they would have had this problem no matter whoever they were with, that Anne felt like her expectations would have been too high no matter who she was with, and that her husband felt like his being emotionally withdrawn at times would have caused trouble for whoever he was married to. And eventually Anne understood that her husband's willingness to tolerate her in her weaknesses and in her unusual approach, his willingness to listen to her, be brutally honest, was itself a form of extraordinary love. And she came to love him again, and happy to say that they have survived. And, you know, they still live with these feelings. But to her surprise, her husband showed her a different kind of love than she'd probably ever expected.
So what's the Poe Bronson takeaway here, then? Is fidelity too much to ask? Is our understanding of family evolving to where infidelity is part of the picture and that's okay? What's the lesson you find here?
Well, the lesson I'd like to say is that infidelity in many cases might be survivable when people imagine it's not. And that's what the three stories in the book teach us. But the real message of the story is don't imagine that marital boredom is not a problem, because it can come to bite you. And, you know, airplane tickets are a lot cheaper than counseling, and babysitters are a lot cheaper than divorces. So if you're experiencing some form of marital boredom, deal with it in advance. And I would like young people who are scared of getting married because they think, what's going to happen when marital boredom sets in? I'd like them to know that it might be hard work, but it's gratifying work. And it's good and it's satisfying work. And constantly being told it's hard work, I think, just turns them off.
Divorce has been a huge issue in this country. Its growth in recent decades. Lots of talk about its impact on children. We're going to talk more about that. But the story of Sarah Iverson, the middle of three children, parents stayed together until the kids were all in college, had the quote-unquote ideal divorce, if there is such a thing. Give us her story, Poe.
Yeah, Sarah was in Hayes, Kansas, which is a small town in western Kansas where divorce was very uncommon. So she felt a great social stigma and such pain. She felt like, why are her parents doing this to her? And on paper, it was an ideal divorce that they had waited. And they were very open about it. But Sarah was unable to accept that her parents were going through this. And then something happened. Her own boyfriend broke up with her. And she found herself grieving uncontrollably. She didn't know why. It was just her boyfriend. And maybe she'd transferred some of the grief from her parents onto this relationship. But a funny thing happened when she experienced grief. Grief is kind of like when you twist your ankle and that swelling happens. It's there to slow you down. And grief taught Sarah what her own parents were feeling in the loss of their divorce. And she got an emotional access to her parents that she'd never had before. She used to be afraid to go to her church because she thought everyone will there be looking at her because she's the divorced kid. And she went to her church and she found that these are actually people who know grief, who've known pain. And grief actually is a portal into sort of a secret society of other people who've been through something. And it gives you access to other people.
So it brought her
sort of
empathy with her parents. But what came from that? The divorce was still there. What's the outcome? What's the Poe Bronson lesson here?
Well, Sarah used to ride around with her family in the back of a car, and her family was so silent. And she got used to that kind of a family. And she thought that was the kind of family was normal. And so when it broke up, she was shattered. But she's learned that there's a different kind of family has fallen in its wake. Both of her parents are remarried. Both of her parents are far more demonstrative and emotional now. And she's open and shares with them, and she likes her half-sisters and half-brothers. And a new type of family has come in that she likes even more than the old family. So again, it's this process of evolution that good things can come from the discord that we see today.
Good things in the discord, resilience, you write a lot about, as coming out of all these challenges. Resilience and a really new understanding? Are we getting more dimensional in our understanding of family? Does that make it healthier? Does that make it better?
Resilience is the trait that I saw demonstrated in these families. It was demonstrating the type of love that they gave each other. And I want people to know that you might look like an alternative family or a so-called alternative family. That doesn't disqualify you from loving each other resiliently and holding on to what you've got.
Let's take a call. I want to turn to Greta, calling from Wayland, Massachusetts. Hi, Greta. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. What I wanted to respond to was the notion about love being the most important thing in families. And I think love is very, very important, but it's basically just a starting point. I'm a parent both by birth and adoption and have also done foster care over the years.
Mm-hmm.
And many of the kids that I care for that have come from families that have basically ended, most through the state,
mm-hmm.
Their parents love them passionately. They love them a lot. The problem comes with doing what you need to do to keep the family functioning. And I think that when we, that the message that I want my child to have is one of, is that if you focus too much on the love, it's a disservice to them.
So does that mean hang in there through thick and thin with Leave It to Beaver, Norman Rockwell, nuclear family, because
no.
Love is not enough? Or what's the message you take away, Greg?
No, well, the message that I take away is that love is not enough. First of all, I do agree that we look back with rose-colored eyes and that families were not ideal back in the 50s and whenever, that we have a lot of strengths today. So I really do connect and affirm what he believes about families. But when you get to the definition of family, because I spend a lot of time thinking about this and talking about this, my child has siblings that are in other families.
Right. But they're also in your family, in a sense.
And right. We're a blended family in a very different way. But that you can love kids and you can love your family and it can still not work as a family.
Through circumstance or lack of commitment.
Well, sometimes the commitment is there, but other things, mental health issues come in the way, illnesses, substance abuse, beyond. But that doesn't mean that there isn't tremendous love, and sometimes even more love than another family that might be working better, more connected.
Greta, thanks for the frontline report there. Paul Bronson, what about it? Love is not enough, says Greta. You've got to have the structure there to support people.
Well, I apologize if I conveyed the idea that simply love in the abstract was. I think she's referring to when I told Mary Garrett's story, how mm-hmm. she's managed to save her children. In each story in this book, you see people dealing with poverty, disruption, mental illness, terrible neighborhoods, legacies that are very scarring. And you see them overcome them, I think pretty much through what Greta is saying, that they were through mutual dependence, not just through emotional feelings, through being there on a daily basis.
For each other.
Providing financial support.
Mm-hmm.
For finding good schools for children. For finding support networks for people. For finding counseling for the mentally ill. And that a family's job is not to run from these problems or to take offense when these problems emerge, but to work through them together.
Pope Bronson, stand by if you would. I want to bring another perspective into our conversation. Joining us from New Brunswick, New Jersey, is David Papineau. He's co-director of the National Marriage Project at Rutgers University. He's also a professor of sociology, author of War Over the Family, Life Without Father. David Papineau, thanks for being with us.
Nice to be with you.
So here's Pope Bronson. He's gone out and talked with a lot of families. He's seen them in all their many new arrays in the United States and beyond. And he's come back with this message of hope that the golden era of the family may be ahead. And he's saying, don't be, in a way, do not be afraid. Do not be made afraid by levels of divorce. Do not be made afraid by everything we've heard of as afflictions of the family. The family's resilient one way or another in spite of that. Do you see that, David Papineau?
Well, I don't really. And I think it's, I guess I would kind of call it a retrograde message. And it's the kind of thing we heard a lot of in the 70s when family breakup was just beginning, but we've come a long way since then, and right now the debate really has shifted to another line. We have children of broken homes now growing up and becoming adults, and they tell you a very different story. I mean, you know, you can put all the happy talk you want out there, but they weren't happy. And secondly, and more importantly perhaps, or as important, we have a whole body of social science research now that suggests that broken families, if we can use that sort of broad term, just don't get the job done as well as intact families do. And just to give one instance, they have about children from broken homes have about 2 to 3 times the number of serious problems in life that children coming from intact, two married parent families have.
Pope Bronson, I don't want to put words in your mouth. And what do you make of this perspective that intact is best?
I'm trying to teach people that staying intact is better. I don't necessarily disagree with David. David's been doing his work since 1988, and I was one of those young children of broken homes who heard his message. The only thing was that when I heard that the state of the family was falling apart so much, I looked at my own family and I looked at society, and I thought, this isn't possible. And I just want to teach people that it is possible. It is possible to stay intact. It is possible to embrace family, that we shouldn't run from the idea and have this fear of family in our lives.
David Papineau, I guess that doesn't sound like happy talk. It sounds like have courage, encouragement.
Well, it's certainly glass half full, half empty. But, you know, obviously people going through family breakup have to look on the bright side, and there's such a thing as good divorces and bad divorces in a broad sense. But I do think that it's important to kind of look at this more from a public health perspective if we're to make advances in this country. And that suggests that the amount of family breakup we have today is way too high, that children are unnecessarily being hurt. And, you know, we really need to think more about how to keep couples together longer and stable, healthy marriages.
So not about redefining family, but about getting back to that 1950s image or coming to something with a new understanding?
Well, you can't get back to the 1950s, but you can certainly strive to achieve what really everybody wants, including people wanting for their own children, and that is, you know, a monogamous marriage that lasts a lifetime when there are children involved. And that doesn't seem to be too difficult a goal to work toward, even though we've had a lot of difficulty in the last few years.
Pope Bronson, is that what you found? Is that too much to ask for these days? Do people need to have other kinds of arrangements countenanced in order to get along, or should that, is that still the goal?
Well, that is a wonderful goal, and I would never contradict that as a worthy goal. But we should never shame people for not being able to live up to that goal. You know, in the divorces today, 20% domestic violence is cited in 20% of divorce cases today in the United States. It's a third in Canada, and it's 40% in the United Kingdom. If you add to that chronic infidelity and alcohol and drug abuse, a lot of divorces give way to a better day. And so I worry about categorically judging people. That's all. I wouldn't disagree with the goal. I certainly hope that my marriage I have today is long-lasting and monogamous. I think most people would want that. It's about when life hasn't delivered that on your plate, you still count, and you can still make family last.
That surely speaks to a lot of Americans these days, because of the kind of circumstances that David Papineau has researched and describes. David, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
David Papineau, co-director at the National Marriage Project. My guest is Poe Bronson. His new book is Why Do I Love These People? We're talking about the evolving family, what family is, and what it means to us. Now, you can join us. Is Poe Bronson right that the golden era of family is somehow not behind us, but ahead? And is there something that family gives us that nothing else can? 1-800-423-8255 is the number. This is On Point.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, BICON.com. And Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the evolving family, what it is, and what it means to us now. My guest is Poe Bronson. His new book is Why Do I Love These People? Honest and Amazing Stories of Real Families. It's not always pretty, but he says, hang in there. And he says, the future of the family is brighter than ever. What do you think? 1-800-423-8255. Craig is calling from Concord, New Hampshire. Hi, Craig. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Poe.
Hi, Craig. How are you doing?
Doing well.
Tom, Craig, you know Poe? Poe, you know Craig?
Yeah, Craig is in my book. Can I introduce him, Tom?
Of course, sure.
Can I take a second?
Okay.
Craig Emery's story is in the book. I'm about to tell you something that is very hard to hear. Craig is from Concord, New Hampshire. His father had a difficult life. His mother died young. Craig left school at 16. He married. He had three children. It was very tough circumstances. But he got another chance at life. And he had a new child named Callahan, who, when he was 2.5 years old, did not wake up from a nap one day. Very tragic and biblical type of circumstance. I've spent the last 3 years getting to know Craig because I am amazed how this really blue-collar guy who spent most of his life as a cashier at Market Basket grocery stores has managed to thrive and deal with the unfortunate and completely inexplicable death of his son. And I'm glad Craig can call in so people can hear him and know he is indeed alive and well. And I was interested in what extraordinary wisdom about healing might come from this very ordinary man.
Craig, it doesn't sound so ordinary. It sounds like a big challenge. What do you take away from the way Poe Bronson's portrayed you and others in the book here? What should we learn about family, Craig?
Well, I think that one of the best parts of the story, and he tells it so much better, I think, than I do, is that, Callahan was my big second chance. And that chance did not end when he passed away. It seemed like it could have. It seemed to me for a while like it did. But what it did is it made me a stronger parent, better person, and the possibility that I might be able to affect change and educate others about this so that way maybe someday they won't have to deal with the same set of circumstances gives me a real passion and a goal in life.
Craig, let me ask you, from what Poe says, it sounds like you had a tough childhood, a broken family, as we call it, and then a death of your own child. Out of all of that, do you think you've come somehow to a better understanding of family than your parents had in their generation, in their time?
I think so. My mom and my dad both came from relatively unaffectionate families with a number of children in each one. They both came from families where alcoholism was prevalent, and that's one of the things discussed in the book, but it's also something that took my mother's life when I was six. So I do think that they, I had a tough time because I didn't get a lot of affection, but it didn't stop me from kind of trying really hard to put that onto my kids, and hopefully they will be better adults towards their children because of it.
And you think it's happening? Have you reached down and found that?
I think more so since my son passed away. Another great kind of quote from the book that he said was that my first the first three children were like your first batch of pancakes. You know, you would feel guilty because you think you could have done better. Now, I got a little chuckle out of that, but I also realized that I could have done better if I was older, if I was more mature, if I had a more loving family, etc. It was my son's, my youngest son, Callahan's life and eventually his death that made me into the parent that I always thought I wanted to be and work towards. And it's an evolving process.
We hear it, and we hear it going right on. And Craig, we're grateful to you for calling. You've got a lot of others who want to join us, and I want to turn to them, if I may. Craig, thank you for your call. Loris is calling from Woburn, Massachusetts. Hi, Loris. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I actually want young people to know that there's hope out there. I'm actually 24 years old. I just got married a few months ago, and I came from a broken home. My parents divorced when I was 5 because my father was bipolar. A couple years after that, my mother had received, she got cancer and died when I was 10.
Oh, wow.
I moved on. I went to school. I lived with my aunt throughout that time.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I didn't have the greatest childhood, but I've overcome that. And through that, I met a really loving person from actually a different culture. My husband is Zimbabwean.
Mm-hmm.
And he showed that there's hope out there. And this culture is amazing. I mean, these people have embraced me. They've shown me love that I've never felt before. And I just wanted to say that there is hope for young people. And also, after my wedding in July, my father had was killed in a car accident in August. Wow. And the only people that really showed me love was his family.
No.
I received calls from England to Africa and all over the United States, and they were all from his family.
Let me ask you, Loris, here's another example of where a culture from abroad, in this case from Zimbabwe, has buoyed you up in your effort to have a loving family around you. What about American culture itself? Was it, is it working for you and supporting that?
It is. I mean, there's many people around my life. I don't know what you'd say about my, you know, upbringing, culture. I mean, I've had different religious backgrounds around me, and I feel like people are very supportive, but the love that I feel from this family compared to, say, my aunt or my grandparents is not the same. They do not take me in, almost, and these people show me love.
And you found it, and you've got it, and it's interesting. And Loris, thank you for your call. It's interesting. Here again, we hear that that encouragement and the need for encouragement of a generation that may not have had a great experience. Paul, let us get another call here. Tom's calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Hey, how are you doing? I love your show.
Thanks, Tom. What's your story?
I just wanted to call and say that I am very hopeful about families, and my girlfriend is too. We've been together for 4 years now. We're very dedicated to getting married, hopefully, in the next couple of years. And trying to use our families, which are not broken but not happy in the past, as a guide to not follow sort of an idea of going the opposite route and striving for what we didn't see when we were growing up.
So you want a family different from your own. You've been together for how long now, Tom?
For about 4 years.
And it still might be a couple before you get married? As Mom might say, what's the holdup?
Well, I guess some money issues, and we're going to try work that out and stuff like that.
Yeah, we hear it, and we wish you well. We wish you luck with it, and thanks for your call. But Bronson, this in these calls, this yearning to make it work, I mean, there must
right.
be a hope, a source of hope in itself. It doesn't go away. People want it. But also this sense that we heard in both of these last two calls of not having come from models that were exactly helpful, of having to make it up in a way on their own, of having to talk themselves into belief that it can be good.
Right, they talk themselves into it. And if anything, that's why it seems so odd to hear that we could even consider going back to the past, because so many people look at the past that they came from and said, I actually want something very different from that. And that's what I mean by the new aspirations we have for family. As Craig said, men want to be nurturing and demonstrative and emotional with their children. And as Tom said, that, you know, we want to do something different than our parents. And as Loris said, we want to support each other in our grief, not withdraw and be scared of grief and not know what to say. That these are the way we choose to interact today. We're really looking for something new, and we're trying to do it. And I heard that kind of hope in my travels, like we're hearing that in these phone calls today.
But do you see a dynamic, Poe Bronson, that's going to put more support, more wind under the wings of these relationships? What's different now from the last generation, when the divorce rate climbed so high, when many of these fears and wounds were created? Is there some cultural change that's going to be more supportive, or are you just seeing determination, you know, in the teeth of the gale?
Ultimately, Tom, I think it's determination in the teeth of the gale. I do believe that, as you heard Tom saying, I'm not going to rush into marriage. I'm going to make sure that we handle the financial obligations part of that and get that squared away before we move ahead. And we are walking through life a little more gingerly, but making sure that every time we put down a foot, it might be a little more stable so that we can have more stable relationships in the years ahead.
So you're saying don't move away from that intact family, but don't feel so shattered by its loss that you lose the faith, the confidence, the vision of the love that can be there. Go for it anyway. It really does sound like a kind of moral support from somebody who's been there himself to a whole generation that may have been disillusioned.
That's very much it, that when I was young, I was disillusioned, and I've discovered that good things have come to pass in my life regards to family, that fear of family used to perhaps loom over my entire life. And I found that in holding family at a distance, I was letting it control me. And by instead being willing and open-minded about family and willing to try to figure these things out, you know, it's great that I have two little kids, and it's great that I'm married, and it's great that I have good relationships with my parents now, but really I'm just glad that fear of family doesn't loom over my life anymore.
Poe Bronson, with a lot of stories of people who had to fight through that fear or through the wounds of their own childhoods, and he says rediscovering family on the other side of all that. They're inspiring stories, Poe. They remind us just what a wild world it can be out there and how people make their way in spite of it. We're grateful to you for bringing them to us. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom. I really appreciate it.
Poe Bronson, author of the new book, Why Do I Love These People? Honest and Amazing Stories of Real Families. To continue the conversation, go to onpointradio.org, click on forums. In a moment, a major change for an imperial family in the Far East. This is On Point. The Japanese imperial family celebrated a noteworthy modernizing event yesterday. Princess Sayako, the emperor's daughter, broke from tradition and married a commoner. In doing so, she's lost her status as a member of Japan's imperial family, a family which has been under enormous pressure to produce a male heir to the throne. With me now to tell us about Sayako's marriage and the succession crisis is Henry Lawrence. He's professor of Japanese politics at Bowdoin College. He joins me from Brunswick, Maine. Mr. Lawrence, thanks for being with us.
Hello, Tom. It's a pleasure to be here.
So give us the family's structure of the imperial family in Japan now and describe what's happened and why.
Well, you have the current emperor, Akihito. He's going to reign until he dies. His son is Crown Prince Naruhito, and he married Masako Owada, who is a Harvard graduate, and they have had a great deal of difficulty finding producing a male heir. Finally, 3 years ago, Masako had a daughter, Aiko, but there are no male heirs in sight for the Japanese royal family, so that after the Crown Prince becomes emperor, there's no heir after that, and that's been a big talking point highlighted by Aiko's birth.
Now, whose daughter is Princess Sayako, then?
Princess Sayako is Akihito's daughter. He has the Crown Prince Naruhito is the eldest son. Then he has another son, and his youngest daughter is Sayako, and she has married out of the family by marrying Yoshiki Kuroda.
Is there any precedent for that in Japanese history or contemporary history? It's a very old imperial family.
The practice of marrying off daughters is very common, and they would typically leave the imperial household. This is the first time that a princess has married a commoner with no royal blood at all. And part of the reason for that is that in 1947, the American occupation got rid of the number of the lesser lines of the imperial household. There aren't that many princes left in Japan, and if Sayako wanted to marry anyone, she pretty much had to marry a commoner.
So, and there's no male heir at the moment. If Sayako had married someone of royal blood, and I don't know how many of those there are left in Japan, but if she had, could she have conceivably produced a male heir for the throne?
That would have been possible, yes, had she done that. But it would also have been a problem had there been an elder daughter of the direct descendant, the Crown Prince Naruhito. So that is now no longer an option for the Japanese anyway.
How big is the population of royalty in Japan for a daughter like Sayako to marry into these days? I mean, how many options does she have apart from commoners?
Very few, and that's one of the reasons why she had to take the course she did. There's people that used to be nobility and royal family, but as I said, that whole genealogy was scrapped by the American occupation.
And what about the future of the imperial family in Japan? If there's no male heir, are we going to see a Japanese empress potentially? Is that possible?
That's what they're debating at the moment, and there is a proposal that has just been made by an advisory panel to the Prime Minister to change the law. The current law, written in 1947, says daughters, females, cannot accede to the throne. If they change the law, and that will probably be debated in the spring of next year, then they will make an exception, and then they'll probably revert back to the system of if there's any male heir anywhere on the horizon, it will be the man, and if there's no one, by default, it will be the woman. But that's not the only possibility. One of the other alternatives, which the Japanese royal family used to do before the war, is to have either an adopted heir. The emperor with only daughters could adopt a male heir, or what they used to do is to have a system of concubines, and in effect the emperor would take a mistress and take as many as he could until he produced a male heir that way. Both of those proposals, I might add, have been suggested by members of the current royal family as alternative ways out of this particular dilemma.
Professor, we've just got half a minute here. How much does this still matter to the Japanese people? You're watching closely. Is the imperial family still very important?
They really don't have the same emotional attachment to the royal family as, say, the British do. It's something that's treated with respect, but not a great deal of love. Most people in Japan overwhelmingly would prefer that they just said that there's going to be a female heir and then get on with it.
Love and marriage in the imperial family in Japan. Henry Lawrence, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Henry Lawrence, professor of Japanese politics at Bowdoin College. He joined us from Brunswick, Maine. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Eileen Imada, Stefano Katsonis, Matt Lieber, Mary Moore, James Ross, Christina Russo, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Matt Odette and Angel Cozzelli. Our senior producer is Joe O'Connor. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.